all these companies, whether they're winning or losing, and most of them are a mix after all these companies have got little things in them that you and I might think are the clues to what happens next.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Media Voices. We are the Media Focus podcast that brings you, all the news and views, I think. We don't miss anything out from the best around bets. The media world.
Just the best bets.
I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston. And that voice you just heard is Colin Morrison, best known now for his incredible Flashes and Flames blog, but actually the former boss of some of the biggest magazine publishers in the world. We spoke about his start in the industry, his almost academic approach to media analysis, and possible winners and losers from the coronavirus crisis.
Oh my God, that's a must listen, because if you can make that bet now, Imagine what a position you'll be in at the end of it all.
Yeah, I've actually already put my bets on, ladies and gentlemen.
But this time we're going to begin with our news roundup, and we're going to be taking a look at whether the pandemic is going to change things for the tech giants. So obviously the entire media industry is to some extent now dependent on Facebook, Google, Amazon, whether we like it or not. And, just as much as the media industry is exposed to it, so too are those tech giants. So from interrupting government probes to skyrocketing usage, the Washington Post's Elizabeth Dwoskin says that the pandemic is actually benefiting those companies. So Peter, why don't you, I suppose, explain where she's coming from with that?
It's a great piece. I mean, it's depressing, I think, unless you're a Google, Facebook, Amazon shareholder. But it's brilliant. And she goes through why the tech giants could end up stronger on the other side of this.
Okay. What's the sort of basic argument? Because on the face of it, they are as exposed to this kind of ad slowdown as anybody.
Well, they are. And yes, they're taking a hit. You know, Amazon's profitability is going to be off because of the additional extra costs that they're taking on. Her point is, this is a scary, depressing part of this. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity to expand their power, crush their rivals, and change their political fortunes. And in a sense, it's the perfect storm. That idea of, there was a bit that the tech lash momentum was building, and there was going to be this new privacy legislation in the States, in California particularly.
So what you're saying is the timing is really suspiciously good.
Yeah, I would never have said that. No way.
Have we taken a look inside Alphabet's labs lately?
No, definitely. I'm not even going there. The real thing is that there's this stuff that's going away. There's also, depending on where your allegiances lies, there's also the idea that they're becoming essential and they're helping, Google's helping out with information and data tracking, and Amazon is an essential service these days, delivering food and medicines and whatever. Facebook, you could argue, is the place where everyone other than on Zoom gets together. So there's all this stuff going on that makes them seem really, really part of the fabric of life.
You know what might have helped with that would have been some sort of oversight prior to this.
Yeah, well, we're a bit late for that, man. The one of the strongest quotes in this, and it's again, depending where you come from, is scary. Eric Google Schmidt. he says that when you have an industry leader and something collapses, the industry leader, if it's well managed, tends to emerge stronger a year later. So I don't know. This piece is really well worth a read. But there's another one. There's Politico did one, which kind of is a flip side of this, and it's saying that people realising how embedded these companies are in their life are going to go, whoa, holy shit, wait a minute. And I don't know.
Yeah.
So I thought this Politico piece was, it was quite a good piece, but I didn't find it that convincing. I just think there's going to be so much going on after this that, okay, so basically the firing line is now elsewhere. Nobody's going to have their eyes on these tech giants. It's going to be like, okay, great, we'll pay attention to them later. And they're going to get away with it. I think it could be 4, 5, 6 years before we get any kind of similar pressure that we've seen on Amazon and Facebook, particularly over the last 2 years. like, we're all looking at Facebook, we're looking at Instagram, we're all looking, you know, we're all shopping on Amazon because we're bored. And it's incredibly likely that when restaurants, when pubs, when everything's reopened again, however long that is, we're going to drop that. We're going to drop the social media stuff as quickly as we picked it up a couple of weeks ago.
I
really hope so, because I cannot take any more of people's albums on Facebook.
Well, I was going to say, how much of this is just based on people sharing their top 10 favourite films on Facebook, Esther? Because I did see that Twitter post.
I did the 10-day album challenge in 4 hours yesterday.
It's, look, Peter Houston coming on here, part of the problem.
I think you're wrong. Both of you, I think, are wrong, because I think what's changing is people are actually understanding that this kind of digital infrastructure is an insanely important part of their life.
You are crazy.
Not telling
you. Think
you.
About it this way, because we comment on the media. The average person doesn't see Facebook and Instagram as a tech giant. It sees it as an
exactly
app, a utility, but they don't go, oh my god, my over-reliance on them is a problem.
No, and that's exactly why I'm saying Esther's wrong, because they're not going to get to the other side of this and go, oh my god, I've just had my screen time report from Apple. Jesus, I spent 43 days in the last week on on screen. They're not going to do that. How long does it take to form a bad habit? Google it.
It depends. Is it heroin?
Okay. Here's another theory.
Going to Mail Online.
Is that the number of people that have started baking sourdough, brownies, painting, learning Spanish, reading magazines, are those habits going to be the ones that stick, so that when you get home from work in the evening, rather than spending your whole evening scrolling through Facebook and Instagram, are you actually going to go back to baking sourdough and learning Spanish?
But you've just proved my point. People will go back to scrolling through Instagram.
No, I don't think they will. I'm hoping that these...
You're agreeing, you fools.
People just get hooked on this shit.
And most importantly, flour will be available.
Why is it that we can't, that the media industry can't weaponize that?
Well, that thing in the same there, that is an insanely brilliant question, Christopher.
But you know what I mean? Like, you know who does do it well are the people who have crossword apps and the people who have cooking apps. But news as a product isn't that kind of, I must check Instagram, I must bake sourdough sort of thing.
Well, actually, what Colin Morrison in our interview called ho-hum content.
Oh.
You know, and Colin's point is that ho-hum content is not good enough anymore if you want to charge people money for it.
That's too real.
The other thing here is that if everybody's been unemployed, if everybody's been laid off, then nobody's going to have money to buy anything.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at the biggest recession since, whatever, the Great Depression. Oh my god, we're really cheering ourselves up today.
I'm suddenly looking back through my Amazon purchases over the last couple of days in the light of that recession, and I'm feeling a little bit like I might return some of this shit, to be honest.
Well, Amazon's taking this hit. Facebook is kind of doing the opposite. They had 18 months of just getting that absolute shit kicked out of them. And now they're like the people's favourite. The best story I saw on this is Brandon Gold's story in Media Post, where on May 15th they're holding this virtual graduation ceremony for America's Year of 2020 or whatever.
You know, I would love, I'm desperate to see the demographic breakdown of usage during the last couple of weeks, because I've seen like everybody of my parents' age flooding back to Facebook, suddenly using it like 10 times more. I have yet to see anybody under 25 pop up that I know.
Why would you? Jesus,
that's the thing, is that I don't think this is going to be enough to turn around the young people to join it. They're all on TikTok.
Me and my brothers, we have our own WhatsApp chat, obviously, and just the last couple of days we've had to sort of say, do we block our parents? Just because it is a relentless onslaught of memes.
So the quote from this article, which, you know, proves that the media is actually still paying attention, the risk is that Facebook and other companies overplay their hand and come to be seen as exploiting the pandemic to the benefit. And I think that's what that Politico article is really spins on, is the idea that people think, oh my god, these people are so big, they're cynical, we've got to do something about this.
But they don't, though. They don't care.
So the flip side of that is that Facebook has also announced the first few people who are going to be joining its oversight board. So these are the people who are going to have veto power over any and all content-related issues with regards to, you know, whether it's right and proper to publish on that platform.
Okay. Whoa.
Well, okay, go on.
So I was reading this piece earlier this week, and I was just like, how is that going to work? Are they just going to... Are they, like, content moderators?
No, it's all policy, isn't it? It's very high-level stuff.
But that is a mammoth task.
No, but they're, like, the Supreme Court.
But, yeah, this is... And I think that there was something as well that they've appointed the first few people who will then appoint more people, and then it's kind of so that Facebook doesn't have too much involvement in the actual selection.
But I think the real point of this is to introduce a level of oversight that's separate from Facebook's actual board, so that management and oversight of content is actually separate. So a bit like a church and state separation.
But what's going to happen here? If Zuckerberg has something that he fundamentally disagrees with them over?
That's the point. They should have the right of veto over that. That's the theory. I don't know if that'll if that happened.
And it's interesting, like, the stuff that has been shared more recently, like this Plandemic documentary. It's been all over Facebook and YouTube. It's all over Instagram. There's some quite prominent influencers who are sharing it. It is obviously bollocks. There is a fantastic, fantastic Reddit thread which debunks every single claim in it minute by minute. And there are, like, 50 incorrect claims in the first minute.
In which case, the next time Trump spouts a load of crap, will that then fall under that same... That should technically then fall under that guidance.
It should, yeah, absolutely. What does all actually mean for our guys, for publishers and media people?
I'm so glad you asked. We could see a lot of publishers being lulled back into a false sense of security.
Yeah.
If there's more engagement on platforms, more engagement on Facebook, more engagement on this and that, publishers could be like, let's go back there, but please don't, I'm begging you, please don't. Because we'll have exactly what's happened with Amazon, where Amazon have, because of the huge boost they've had over the last couple of months, they've said, oh, we don't need publishers anymore, and they've completely slashed their affiliate rates and screwed a bunch of people.
So there you go, me and Esther absolutely 100% agree.
And now on to the news in brief for this week. And the owner of the Daily Mirror, Daily Express and Daily Star newspapers has revealed the extent of the lockdown's impact on publishers. It's reported a 30.5% fall in revenues in April, including a slump in digital income despite soaring online readerships. And we're taking this from Mark Sweeney in The Guardian. That is actually less than I thought.
That just shows how screwed we thought everything was.
And some growth news, actually, from a publisher. Wired UK has said it will grow revenue by 10% this year. So according to Digiday, their early moves to diversify its revenue streams and broaden editorial coverage beyond tech have actually put it in a really strong position. So they've not yet furloughed or laid off any staff, and they're forecasting, 10% growth, which, I mean, it's not as much as they were forecasting before the pandemic, but it's growth, so that's good.
That's your mix of six in practice there, Peter.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's consultancy and events and all sorts on there. Events are probably not so good right now, but there's all sorts on there. Story in the FT about a two-year study by PricewaterhouseCoopers. Only half online ad spend actually makes it to publishers, which is pretty terrifying.
Yeah, that has been known internally at a lot of places for quite some time, and you'll hear people talk about that at conferences and everything. And in fact, that, do you remember 2 years ago, The Guardian found that only they were only receiving a third
of
the ad spend. And it's so this has been known for a while, but this is a fantastic longitudinal study that has demonstrated it exactly.
The guy that commissioned it, or the organization is, but the commissioned it, the director general, Phil Smith, says the market is damn near impenetrable. That's just nuts.
And you know what's worse than that? It has been cleared out slightly over the past couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
And Esther, this goes back to something you were talking about earlier. Jeff Jarvis reckons that the subscription boost around coronavirus is only going to be temporary. So it's not necessarily as habit-forming as you might have expected.
We'll fight about this on an episode 150. And BuzzFeed is aiming to keep their coronavirus losses under $20 million, a casual $20 million. they've actually announced this week salary reductions and furloughing of at least 68 employees, which is, you know, a shame, but unfortunate.
I think this is a good story. So the Orange Man baby in America is trying to block a loan to the Postal Service until it raises its prices so they can have a go at Amazon. It's all bullshit, as per usual. But this story in The Nation is actually saying, how about you recognise that the 30,000 post offices across America are local anchor institutions for small communities and turn them into media hubs, local media hubs? I think that's a brilliant idea, and I think that should be looked at in this country.
Well, in that case, I'm just going to move very quickly on to this next one. Whoever gave this to me needs to have a long, hard look at their life. Facebook's portal is now apparently a hit.
Oh, there you go. That's good news.
Excellent. Facebook, building that reputation.
Portal is like next their one. Little, like, what, tablets that you can just call people on that just get your grandparents a cheap tablet and then they can check their emails on it as well. Don't waste your money on this. Oh, my word, I need sleep.
Based on my grandparents' experience, no, they cannot.
Talking of people's grandparents, Judi Dench has just become British Vogue's oldest cover star. She's 85, she's wearing Dolce & Gabbana, and she is brilliant. The end. Great story. This week I spoke with Colin Morrison of the Flashes and Flames blog. We covered all sorts, from his time leading some of the world's biggest magazine companies to Clever magazine analysis and the coronavirus inevitably. But first, I asked him how he got started in magazines.
Well, I came to London a long time ago, 1969. I'd spent the previous 11 years at boarding school, which is why I couldn't contemplate for one second going to uni, even though I had reasonable exam results. And so I started a clerical job at the BBC in a newspaper cuttings library that helped me do my first journalism, because I was using their files. And then I got a job on Lloyd's List, which is where I kind of learned to be a journalist. And at the same time, when I was working at Lloyd's List, I was freelancing, writing a pop music column for the Sunday Press, which was an Irish Sunday newspaper, and also occasionally writing for the Evening Standard and Radio Times. So quite early on, I was really lucky. I'd always wanted to be a journalist. I found myself swimming in work and doing three or four jobs most of the time, and learning to do the job because I never had any formal training. From that, I found myself eventually editing magazines in the sort of maritime and fishing businesses for Reed. And I found myself at Reed on and off for about 10 years and became a publisher and then managing director of Bits of Reed and so on. And then I moved on from that to running essentially magazine companies at Reed, at EMAP, Hearst, Future, Axel Springer in England and Australia. So I found myself getting quite easily at the time, it was a different time then than now, found myself quite easily able to get into media and into journalism, which is where I'd wanted to be. But actually, I found myself easily shifted out of journalism into publishing and the commercial affairs of media. And that's what I then did for the following 30 plus years.
What was the big shift that you made, that you kind of went from journalism to the business side, to the dark side, some might call it?
Yeah, I was really naive about how companies worked, you know, how meetings were run, all kinds of the formalities of business. I had no idea of that at all. I was pretty numerate, but I had no skills financially or anything. But what I realized after a time is that Reed and IPC were huge enterprises, mostly run by people with an advertising sales background. And I think the assumption was that they were the guys who understood money and the rest of us didn't. Whereas actually it became obvious to me and to other people that actually journalists brought something new to that, because journalists understood the readers, or understood what readers wanted, or how to market to readers with journalism. So I actually found that I, at different times in my career, particularly early on, I actually found there were very few journalistically inclined, and if you like, people who are passionate about journalism, involved in the management of these companies. And that, you know, inadvertently, that became an advantage that I played for my own benefits. You know, I did well and I was lucky, but I found myself working for very good companies with very good publishing teams and so on. And I found that my journalistic skills were a lot more useful to me than I would ever have guessed.
Do you think that's still the case? Do you think more publishers should be looking outside the commercial area for leaders?
Well, I definitely think that it's a bit like the gender discussion. You've got to go for a balance of skills and people and attitudes and everything else. And so it is quite similar to that same thing about should there be more women or more men and all the rest of it. There should be a mix of all kinds of people. But I think one of the challenges in media today, because the competition is so great, you can get information and news and media of different sorts and education and entertainment. There's so many different places. So you've got to be better and better. I grew up as a publisher in a world where you could get away with a lot of ho-hum content. Today, when you need readers to pay, because advertising isn't as easy as it once was, you mostly need readers to pay. So you need to focus on giving them something that they really can't get anywhere else. Because if they can get it somewhere else, they will. And if they can get it somewhere else, they won't pay you for it. And so when it comes to it, to answer the question, when it comes to it, there's got to be a journalistic assessment of what is the information that my reader or user will die for or will pay for. And on the whole, the person who designs that information and goes in search of it and builds that information is more likely to be a journalist than anybody else.
So it's a mix that's important, though. It's not, you know, it's making sure that each of those voices is represented on the, well, whether it's a board level or whether it's just actually making publication level decisions.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it'd be ridiculous to have companies that are entirely journalistic. And I think in the old days, when you look at how some newspaper companies really atrophied and fell to pieces over a long time and managed to get in a position where they couldn't cope, they were very often run by editors exclusively without really sufficient business skill and marketing skill and broad interests to become strong businesses. So you've got to have that mix.
It used to be easier than it is now. No one's going to argue about that one. Do you remember ever thinking, this isn't as easy as it used to be? Can you pinpoint when that change came?
I sort of do. One of the things I enjoyed most about the early chunk of my career, about 10 years of my commercial career, was at Reed during the days when B2B publishing, and we were publishing, in fact, I was publishing B2B and specialist consumer publishing, so a chunk of what then became IPC. And what in those days, particularly in B2B markets, you were able to get away with launching lots of new magazines, conferences, exhibitions. There seemed to be a limitless opportunity. And after a time, I realized that actually sometimes we kind of had a good idea, produced quite a good product, but nobody had paid that much attention, say, to the circulation marketing or subscriptions or quite often these controlled circulation databases. We just skated across that because we'd majored on what an exciting magazine we were making. And it became clearer to me as the 90s went on that actually, you know, quite often that had been the case, either with controlled circulation, after all, being a free marketing channel. When there was an explosion of controlled circulation magazines, they either were journalistic things that quite often fudged the circulation story and just kind of told a sort of generalized truth about what the circulation was without really doing the research, without building a list that was worth very much, or else they just did that and produced a magazine that really nobody wanted to read at all, but there was enough advertising around, so you made a living. And as the 90s went on, it became more difficult, and you did definitely have to be more professional all round. And I suppose those were the years when I came to appreciate that teams are much better than individuals. And it's back to the earlier point. You get three or four people of disparate talents and attitudes together, you end up with a much better game, and you end up challenging the nonsense that you can get carried away by if you're all by yourself.
people now maybe know you better for Flashes and Flames than they do for your senior management and big publishing companies.
Yeah, it's a bit disconcerting, really, because it's been a minority of my life, even though I love it. But I do sometimes have to explain to people that I did run the odd company, and I once took myself very seriously. Flashes of Flames, originally, I started in 2011, which is a long time ago, when I had only just heard of WordPress. And so I'd heard of blogging, but scarcely so. I didn't read any blogs. And I did it as an experiment to try and find out what blogging was all about and what WordPress was and so on. And so I sort of played around for a few years. And probably I was doing that until 3 or 4 years ago. So just every now and then writing something that I wanted to write. But what was in my mind all the time, by then I had developed into the career that I've got now, which is mostly advising media companies, particularly traditional media companies, but not only, on how to navigate this change to the new world, to become fully digital and to compete with different kinds of companies and information providers. So I was going through that journey professionally myself. And so I found myself increasingly obsessed by the traditional companies that knew what they were doing and had some good ideas, and those that didn't. And the new companies who knew exactly how to play the traditional companies and those that couldn't. And so I found myself kind of approaching it, particularly in the last few years, in the sort of almost an academic way, almost as case studies, trying to tell a story of a company. Mostly I'm talking about companies that I've known very well over a very long period of time. So the historic flavor that I sometimes kind of indulge in my write-ups, you know, sort of comes naturally from my memory.
I love the fact that you've actually used the word obsessive. Because, you know, for people that haven't read Flashes and Flames, and they absolutely should, these reports are incredible. The level of detail that is in some of these things is just nuts.
Well, but you know as well as I do. I won't say I don't like your compliments, because I do. But in truth, I'm writing about things that I love. I'm writing mostly about things I know. I do a lot of research to make sure I check things, and I try never to get things wrong and make sure I corroborate facts. But mostly I am wandering around a village I know very well and trying to look for the significant things. And so it's just that all these companies, whether they're winning or losing, and most of them are a mix after all these companies have got little things in them that you and I might think are the clues to what happens next. So that's the thing I'm always looking for. And in a way, that's why I mostly don't do interviews. I talk to the people running these companies frequently, and I make notes and keep notes, but I'm mostly not doing it. I'm not interested in somebody giving me their PR spiel about why their company is so good. I'm really looking for my version of it.
And in terms of who reads it, is it just people like us, people like me, just geeking out on the background of a publishing company?
I'm pleasantly amazed at how many people do find it, because, of course, I'm not really marketing. And I would say that and the readership is very heavily concentrated in the UK and the US, and pretty heavily concentrated in London and New York, in truth. And I suppose mostly, you know, the core readership, I think, are the people running these companies, you know, media companies of one sort or another, particularly those that are close in some way to the world that we once defined as print, you know, so traditional media in that sense. I would say I've got a very large percentage of the target chief executives and their teams of these companies. But also a lot of people who are just interested, people like I might be, people who are ambitious. You know, but I try to think of the audience as being people who are either running these businesses or in 5 or 10 years' time will be. That's what I'm trying to aim for, because to a limited extent, I suppose I identify myself with that.
And it's changed a little bit recently. you know.
Well, the funniest thing in a way, you know, you and I have been in publishing a long time, and it took me rather a long time to realize that you do get, even if you don't promote, you do get more readers and more habit-forming readership if you just do some basic things like publish at the same time all the time and publish more or less within a channel. You know, you more or less meet expectations in some way. So it took me a long while because I only started doing that about 2 years, perhaps 3 years ago. Now I publish every Friday, 7:30 a.m. London time. And a very large percentage of the entire audience reads it on the Friday. So I've proved to myself what in the past I always knew, because when we published magazines late, we ended up with less readership. You know, we just knew that. So it's funny that it took me a long time to realize. And I do publish, in addition to the kind of main stories I tend to write, publish kind of details of deals and things as part of the context for this, because in a way, deals are the clue as to how the tectonic plates are shifting. But so it's a little bit more of a slightly more serious publishing operation now. I even have an advertiser now, as you may have noticed, Readly, supporting it.
And then in terms of where you want to go with Flashes and Flames, have you got any big ambitions, aspirations for it? Are you happy with the way it is?
No, you know, when you get older than about 50, your ambitions are different kinds of things, aren't they? I think more of the same, honestly. I think that Flashes and Flames now is more than it's ever been before, an extension of the work I do in advising companies and talking to companies about what they might be doing. Some of my work naturally flows into it. Some of it certainly comes directly from it. So it's kind of a center of the little world that I inhabit, I suppose. But, you know, when you really look at it, the difficulty, the challenge, the endless search for the ways of coping in this multi-platform world, you know, those difficulties haven't diminished at all. In fact, you know, they must have intensified over this few years, and perhaps even more so now. So I think there's more demand for serious discussion and study and exploration of the kind of themes that I've been pursuing for quite a long time.
So coming right up to date with the coronavirus crisis and where we are right now, I hesitate to even ask you what you think, but I mean, is it going to be really big losers out of this? Is there going to be any winners at all?
Well, I think that it's almost become, some of us have become very glib about the fact that the virus seems to accelerate, or seems likely to accelerate, trends that are underway anyway. But I suppose that it is difficult to escape from the fact, because if you think of local newspapers today suspending print, many of them, and you would know them as well as I do, there are large numbers of newspapers that are not currently printing, and a very large percentage of all of them were losing money before they took that decision, before the virus came along. So, you know, a lot of those guys therefore whereas they were holding off from stopping printing because they felt that they might be able to find a way somehow. The next decision is whether they bring it back, which I think is a much more challenging decision for them. So I think you could guess that quite a lot of print will disappear during this period. Now, you know, you still talk about a world where people are spending more money, taking more time, and more concerned than ever about media information and entertainment. It's just that the world is much bigger than it was when those of us involved in print felt as if we're in the middle of it. You know, there's lots of opportunities, of course there is, but it's very competitive.
Do you think there's anyone who's going to come out of this better than they went in?
I think there are a fair number of companies who will suffer relatively little damage from it. For the sake of argument, I mean, if you were running a magazine business, the magazine industry doesn't feel full of health, but if you were running a magazine publisher whose revenue was overwhelmingly from subscriptions, then you might not notice much happening during the 3 or 4 or 5 months that we're going to suffer like this. So I think you've got to think of life a bit like that. Because if you take, conversely, the magazine publishers who depend on the newsstand, they're suffering not because readers kind of don't want what they were doing. They're suffering because they were pretty dependent on advertising, which has largely gone away over the last few years, and also dependent on the retail news trade, newsstand. And the newsstand, of course, during this period has failed them because of the restrictions. So you could see that they had a pretty tough time before, and they now have a tougher time. So it's kind of, there's a bit of serendipity about how you go into the crisis, how you got to this point, as well as who owns you and what they expect. You know, it's very noticeable that you take a company like Hearst, which has been, you know, one of the sort of shiny lights for 100 years of all kinds of media, just moving in and out of different channels of media, tending to be more successful more or less everywhere in turn, you know, and being genuinely very versatile. If you take that company, they made the decision not to lay a single person off regardless, and actually to give all their employees worldwide a 1% of salary bonus. Yeah. Now, you know, that's a statement by a company that doesn't expect to suffer.
But do you think that's just the fact that they were looking forward a long time before this came, or you know, and that's that idea of serendipity that they were actually on it?
The difficulty today is that for the traditional companies, and Hearst, of course, still are largely traditional, but the difficulty has the traditional business has got to be managed as well as possible because you generate cash from it. It's what traditionally brought you here. And at the same time, in a completely different way, you've got to find other things to do that in the future will be more important to you. So you've got to have a specific frame of mind, a specific mindset that says, I will devote some real resources, some real time, and even some of my best people to looking for something that I don't even know what we're looking for. And you've got to have that view because, and the reason why you've got to have that view is because in Silicon Valley, somebody who's never been employed by anybody has got out of bed this morning and thought up something that you and I couldn't imagine. And tomorrow it could be a very successful media business. If you're running a traditional business, say back in the day when I was, a little bit of R&D, you know, go and have a look at a magazine market, see if you can launch a trade show there. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about putting real resources into finding whatever it is that we could do in the future with what we know about the world. And you can't do that with the odd junior from business school. You know, you've got to have some of your best people and some real money and do the kind of experimentation that, for the sake of argument, drugs companies routinely do. And I think this period has just made that worse, just made it more difficult because that shifting that was slowly moving along and making life quite difficult, particularly for print publishers, has just become much more difficult. So coming out of this, even if your readers haven't shifted much, the advertisers who already have defected very largely to digital media have gone even further by now.
So what would you be saying to someone if they came and said, right, I'm thinking about what comes next. I'll get past this, but I don't know what to do next.
You know, there isn't any, and you know as well as I do, that there isn't really anything new in the world in the sense if you've got a customer and, you know, you're trying to sell something to him, really, whether you really want his money or just his time or whatever. But that's what you're trying to do. The difference in me, so trying to assess what your customer, what this reader or this user wants, what they will pay for, what is special to them that they can't find anywhere else, is much more important than it used to be. There was a time when people were quite happy that 3/4 of what you gave them in your package of information, your newspaper, magazine or whatever, 3/4 of it could have been stuff that could have been everywhere else. And just a few percent of it might have been special, or perhaps not even that. Perhaps people would put up with the fact that I know that this is nearly everywhere. I kind of like this because it arrives on a Thursday. And we all know now that there are loads of places to find information, and that what we're really looking for is we're looking for the quality information, not the quantity. So the very highest value information, the stuff that I can't get anywhere else, I have to buy from you. It almost doesn't matter whether you're talking about in print or digital or broadcast or audio or something. If you can't get it anywhere else, if I've got something you want and I've worked out what that should be and how I should develop that information, if I've got that, then I've got a business and you've got to buy from me.
We always end these interviews by asking people to recommend some kind of media to our listeners, something that you've enjoyed.
One of the best books about media I've ever read, and it's not the best in a conventional sense, but Nicholas Coleridge, yeah, who of course ran Condé Nast for a good number of years, very successfully, and he wrote a book called Paper Tigers that was a series of essays about basically the families controlling newspaper groups around the world. There are about a dozen different families, ironically not including the Murdoch family, but more or less everyone else you could think of. And they were really pithy, interesting, insightful essays, not just into the types of people, because Nick Coleridge has certainly got a sharp wit and was quite acidic about some people, but he gave a really kind of instant handle on the historic development of these family companies. And so that was one of the things that I go back to all the time.
We have just finished the first week's worth of issues of our Media Roundup, which is our daily newsletter. We're hoping that it'll continue to be succinct and valuable, and it will just bring you the top 3 to 4 stories you need to know each day that will make a difference to you and the industry. So if you want to sign up to that, go to voices.media and there'll be a friendly pop-up.
While you're there, you can also check out our archive of previous episodes, and they are effectively a time capsule now. Just because if you go back even 2 years, we're speculating on stuff that has not only come to pass, but has fundamentally changed the media industry. So you can listen to them all there, or you can read some transcripts from our more recent episodes as well.
And if you want to follow along regularly with what we're looking at in terms of media news, follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod. You can see stories there every single day.
And if you enjoyed this episode or you enjoy our new daily newsletter, please do forward them along to somebody else. We want even more friends in the media world, and this is one of the fastest ways to do it. But until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest, thank you very much for listening. Stay safe and goodbye.
Bye, friends.
Stay home.
Stay home.
Get sleep.